Open with me to John chapter 2. John chapter 2. In class, it's good to be with y'all this beautiful morning. I don't know about y'all, but this weather just puts me in a good mood. I like each season, but when I was in Florida, for 3 years, I missed fall to pieces. And one of the best care packages I ever got was my parents had just sent me a bag of leaves. And I just absolutely love fall and love everything about it. It just puts me in a good mood, and it's so good to be here with y'all this morning. What I'd like to do this morning is I would like to continue looking at the Gospel of John. So as we started last week, 1 John, as we're studying, going to be starting actually next week in the auditorium class Sunday mornings, is written to give encouragement and assurance and knowledge. And John in that epistle states that ultimately all of our assurance and all of our knowledge we have rest on the belief that Jesus is the Christ. And for us as Christians, I don't think there's anything more foundational than establishing that Jesus is the Christ. All the other teachings of Jesus rest upon the claim that Jesus is the Christ. So last week what we did was we began looking at some evidence in the Gospel of John. And what I'd like for us to do this morning is I would like for us to look back in the Gospel of John and do a comparison. What I think we're going to see, we're going to go into three different miracles of Jesus this morning, and three different signs of Jesus, is people responded to the signs of Jesus differently. Some considered him, but some resulted in controversy. And I want us to use this comparison to then try to figure out how we should respond to Jesus. So as a brief summary last week, and I tried to take this in a short paragraph, we established that we believe in Christ only once we see his glory, which is visible only after we cease to desire for the glory of this world. So in John chapter 12, as John in the very middle of that book, that's really the crucial decision point for the disciples at that point, John gives this aside, and he really gives an explanation for why so many people were yet to believe in Jesus. They had seen seven signs, and yet they did not believe that Jesus was the Christ. And ultimately because they were seeking the glory of this world, which blinded them from the glory of Christ, which then blinded them from recognizing he was the Son of God. And so for us to then believe that Jesus is the Christ, we have to see that Jesus is the Christ only once we see the glory of God, and then we see the glory of God only after we seek desire for glory of this world. And then this morning, I'd like for us to then answer this question, how both will and should we respond to the glory of Christ? What we're going to do is we're going to look in a bit more depth at three signs of Jesus that he did this morning, and we're going to see there's different responses. What should they be? Well, as we look at the first two signs of Jesus, again, looking at the structure of the book of John, John has a thing with sevens. There are seven signs in John 1 through 11. It is a climax up to the resurrection of Lazarus, and we'll talk about that in 2 weeks. And as you lead up to this point, there's various responses that people have had. But the very first of the signs that we really see Jesus complete is in John chapter 2. So as he performs the seven signs, the first one that we see is in John chapter 2, where he turns the water to wine. So let's go ahead and read this text together. John chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. John 2, beginning in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus was also invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to his servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now drain some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it out. When the master of the feast tasted the water had now become wine and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone who serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. but you have kept the good wine until now. This is the first of the signs that Jesus did in Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. So first, a few notes about what occurs here. As a context to this, this sign has nothing to do with drinking of alcohol. It is so sad to me that any time I hear this sign brought up, it's almost always, well, Jesus drank wine. That's another sermon, and I'm not even going to deal with that this morning. No, I don't drink alcohol, never had a drop in my life, have no desire to. But that is not the purpose of this story, that Jesus drank wine, therefore we can. The purpose of this story is far greater than that. What this is doing is in verse 11. In this sign, Jesus manifested his glory. So this is about something far greater. And this is ultimately about the glory of Christ. Now again, this ties back to our theme from last week, where we recognized that we see Jesus as Christ only once we see his glory. And his glory is only seen when we stop ceasing the glory of this world. But this is the first sign where Jesus manifested his glory. Now, a couple notes about this. First of all, Mary asked for a miracle. So this was a detail of the text I had skipped over for a long time. But as you look up in verse 1, the mother of Jesus was there. Why is that detail there in the text? Okay. The third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Out of all the people in attendance, the mother of Jesus Christ is mentioned in the text. Well, I think we're going to see why. Because Jesus was invited to the wedding with his disciples. Now, first of all, again, let's notice just this interesting detail. I want to read the text. The third day there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and Jesus Christ was there. His mother was also there. That's not what the text says. It says there was a wedding in Cana at Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited with his disciples. The focus of this text is Mary. Mary is really the center focus of this, because out of all the guests, the one that's really given primacy here is Mary. And it says then in verse 3, when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." So whenever Mary, the mother of Jesus, goes to him and says, "They have no wine," what was she asking? Was she asking her son, "Son, you're a carpenter and I'd like for you to go get some wine for these wedding guests"? No. Whenever she says, "They have no wine," Jesus knew exactly what his mother meant. His mother was asking for a miracle. Now, why would Mary ask for a miracle? I mean, Jesus is around 30 years old at this time. He is 30 at this time. And as you look at the past, Mary was the first person to really be told that really the child you have is going to be the Son of God. And then it tells us in the book of Luke, it's a beautiful story. This is a sermon for another day. But Mary held all these things in her heart. She treasured them in her heart. And Mary, as she grew her son up in wisdom and in stature and in knowledge, she would have seen no telling how many wonderful things from her sinless son, because she was raising the Son of God in her house. And here then, the mother of the Son of God says to him, "They have no wine." She was asking for a miracle. What he was saying was, "My son, I know you have this ability. Just get us some wine." I mean, she knew that her son was the one who was going to come to save the world. He was truly divine. He was truly capable of doing miracles. And so then she asked for a miracle. And so then Jesus calls for the water, and he calls that they fill it to the brim so that nobody can question that Jesus made this to wine. So ultimately here, Jesus is saying, fill it to the brim so that nobody can say that there was actually a little bit of wine in there. But I want it to be certain that I made this water to wine. And so then he turns the water to wine. The master of the feast tasted it, and he exclaimed about how wonderful it was. And then he says he manifested his glory. And what's the outcome of this? His disciples believed in him. His disciples believed in him. Earlier in chapter 1, Jesus calls really his first true disciples who are going to follow him for 3 years. And this is the first sign where they really come to believe in him in the book of John. So what John is showing us here is, yes, the mother of Jesus asked for a miracle, but she already believed. Mary already believed that Jesus was the Christ. Mary already knew that she had the Son of God in her presence. So Mary knew, and she then says, get some wine for us. And so then Jesus does this miracle, and the outcome of this is, as his glory was manifested, his disciples believed in him. So ultimately, what's the purpose of this first sign? The mother of Jesus already knew, but Jesus manifests his glory so that his disciples believe in him. It's a good outcome. His disciples believe in him. Well, then as we go over to John chapter 4, we're going to see the second sign with the raising of the nobleman's son. So the second sign that Jesus does in the book of John is in John chapter 4. So again, let's read this text. John 4, beginning in verse 46. John 4, 46. He came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. This man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee. He went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. And Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And he was going down. His servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew what the hour was when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed in all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. Now, let's note a couple of textual ideas here. First, in verse 46, where's Jesus? Jesus is at Cana in Galilee, where he made the water to wine. Where Jesus did his first sign, he's about to do the second. And then at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. Now, if you go from Capernaum to Cana, this is only 16 miles. I mean, this is only 16 miles. On my Fitbit, that would be about, so let me think through this, that would be about 30,000 steps, okay? The American Heart Association recommends you get 10,000. So this is about 30,000 steps that he would have been making. Ultimately, if he can get his son back alive, not that big of a deal. But what's interesting is if you look at the topography of the land, this is actually a 3,531-foot ascent from Capernaum to Galilee. So while this may only be about 30,000 steps, he is having to make a huge ascent. And so it says, whenever this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked for him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. This man's son was about to die. So this loving father goes to Jesus, and he then asks him, he goes 16 miles, about 30,000 steps, and then he climbs 3,531 feet up to get to Jesus Christ. Now, let's notice a couple similarities here. Do you notice how parents have to do with both of these first signs? The Mary, the mother of Jesus, asked for the sign. And so she already knew that her son was the Christ. And so then she calls, make some wine for us. And after he does this, all his disciples believe. Well, at this point, his disciples already have a bit of belief, but now it's a father. In the first story, we had a mother who already believed. In this story, we have a father who kind of believes, but he's really going to believe after this sign is done. And so Jesus tells him, verse 48, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The reason Jesus heals this man's son is not just for the son, but it's for the father. And this is really important to understand in the story. The reason Jesus does the sign is not for the son, but it's for the father. The reason Jesus heals this man's son is not just to make the son good again, but it's so that the father in all the household may believe. So when Jesus speaks this to him, he says, verse 50, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. After then, he comes home in verse 53, and after he recognizes his son has lived, then it says in verse 53, he himself believed with all his household. And this was now the second sign that Jesus did when he'd come from Judea to Galilee. So let's understand why Jesus did each of these. Jesus in John 2 turned the water to wine so that his disciples would believe. The reason Jesus made the water to wine was not for the purpose of the guest. It was not even for his mother. It was for the disciples. Jesus wanted his disciples to believe in him. He had just told Nathanael earlier in chapter 1, Nathanael, your eyes won't be able to behold all that you're going to see. You won't be able to perceive all that's going to happen. And so he then gives them a sign so that they may believe. Now in John 4, what we see is Jesus is giving a sign so that the Father may believe. The reason Jesus is giving these signs is so that they may believe. And ultimately the reason he's doing this is because Jesus knows what's in man. Let's go back to John chapter 2 and read verse 23. John chapter 2, verse 23. He was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast. Many believed in his name, but when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus, on his part, did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people and needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man. Why does Jesus turn the water to wine? Because he knew what's inside of these men. He knew what their thoughts were. He knew what their intentions were. He knew who they were. He knew they needed a sign, so he gave them a sign. And he knew that this nobleman from Capernaum, whose son was ill to the point of death, he knew that this man needed a sign to believe, so he gives him a sign. Jesus knew what was in man, and he gives them a sign so that they may believe. But you notice what's interesting about these first two signs in the book of John, water to wine and the nobleman's son? They both believed. Both of these have good outcomes. The disciples believe and the nobleman believes. Unfortunately, that's not always going to be the outcome of Jesus' signs. As we look at the third sign that Jesus does in John chapter 5, we're going to see a mixed approach and mixed responses to Jesus. So as we look now at John 5 at the third one, Christ is going to heal the lame man. So let's read the first seven verses. John 5 beginning in verse 1. There was a feast of the Jews and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So there was in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which had five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew what he had already been there for a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred, and when I'm going, another one steps down before me." So, do you notice a couple of things about this man already? Now, first of all, getting a context for this, if you trace the Passovers, this is 1 year after he turned the water to wine. So there's a 1 year difference in time between John 2 and John 5. 1 year has passed. And then you're going to have about, it's less than a week is going to take up around 40% of the book of John. But there's been about a year to pass between John 2 and John 5. And so at this point, Jesus comes and he finds a lame man. And so he finds this lame man who had been invalid for 38 years. And Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be healed?" Now, this is kind of a stupid question to this man. Because let's understand what Jesus is saying here. Here you have a man at the pool of Bethesda, and this pool had supposed miraculous healing powers, and he'd been crippled 38 years, and Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be healed?" I mean, it would be kind of like someone pulling up to a gas station, opening their car, the back of their car with a gas tank. "Do you want gas?" "Yeah." This would be like a waitress or a waiter going up to a family at a restaurant. "Are you hungry?" "Yeah." I mean, it's kind of why I'm here, isn't it? And so whenever Jesus asked this man, do you want to be healed? I mean, his answer is kind of like, yeah, but no one's going to put me down in the pool. So Jesus here is asking this question, which to this man is kind of like, well, yeah, just no one's put me down in the pool yet. But first, I want us to see, where does this man put his faith? The reason I think Jesus asked the man this question is so that he can figure out where his faith is. Whenever he asks him, do you want to be healed? The man does not respond, yes, Jesus, Son of God, heal me. But he says, no one's going to put me down in the water. And then whenever I try to get there, someone goes before me. This man's faith is in the water. That's going to change, verse 8. Jesus said to him, get up, take up your bed and walk. And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now the day was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who'd been healed, it is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed. But he answered them, the man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk. They asked him, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn as there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, see, you are well, sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, my Father is working until now, and I am working. So it's an interesting text, because what Christ is doing here is he's healing this lame man, and he's healing him on the Sabbath. But we're finding conflicting responses to Jesus. Now, first of all, when Jesus heals this man does not know that it was Jesus who healed him. And so when the Jews recognize this, they say, who healed you? He doesn't know. Jesus, however, intentionally goes back to this man later and says, sin no more, ultimately so that he may know it was Jesus Christ who healed him. And then this man goes away proclaiming, it was Jesus who healed me. So again, Jesus is giving faith to this man. But I don't think this is the purpose of this story. The central figure of this story is not the lame man, but I think it's going to be the Jews. Because I want us to notice that a different reaction. The man is healed. Verse 13. The man who'd been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn as there was a crowd in the place. The man was healed. And then he has faith in Jesus and he proclaims it was Jesus who heals me. But the Jews want to kill Jesus. Verse 18. This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. Why in the world does this happen? In the words of my generation, that escalated quickly. this just doesn't make sense. I mean, Jesus heals a lame man, and then they want to kill him. What? I mean, this just makes absolutely no sense. Can you imagine a doctor curing a patient of cancer, and then all the other patients and all the other people want to kill the doctor? Cure me. Help me. I mean, to me, that would be my reaction. If you have a man who's been lame 38 years and Jesus doesn't even touch him, but just says, take up your bed and walk, and then he's healed, why in the world would you want to kill this man? I mean, it makes no logical sense at all. If you found a man who can actually heal these people, send them back to the pool. I mean, if I'd been a Jew, go back to the pool, heal the rest of them, get the rest of them out of there. But they want to kill him. Why? Well, the central detail of this text is one short little sentence in verse 9. At once the man was healed and he took up his bed and walked. And you'll notice this little sentence in the second part. Now the day was the Sabbath. Christ is looking for a conflict. Christ knows what's going to happen when he heals on the Sabbath. Christ intentionally heals for the Sabbath. Christ could have gone back on a Sunday. He could have gone back on a Monday. He could have gone some Sunny Tuesday. You know, this man wasn't going anywhere. This man was by the pool. He could have gone the day before. He could have gone a couple days after. This man still would have been there. But Christ heals on the Sabbath. Why does Christ heal on the Sabbath? Why didn't he choose a Monday? Why didn't he do it the third Thursday of the month? But he did it on the Sabbath? It's because Christ is looking for the conflict. And what Christ is ultimately going to be able to do is that this is going to give Jesus an opportunity to show himself as Christ to these people. So picking up in verse 19, Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. And greater works than these will he show him, so that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he will. The Father judges no one, but has given all judgment to the Son, that all may honor the Son just as they honor the Father. Whoever does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him. Truly, truly, I say to you, whoever hears the word and believes in him who sent him may have eternal life. He who does not come into judgment, but is passed from death to life." Christ is looking for a conflict in this case. And what Christ is doing is it gives him an opportunity where he can teach them, yes, I'm the Christ. Now let's notice, his argument essentially is this. That God's working. God's working on the Sabbath. Verse 17, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." Verse 19, "The Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise." What the Father does, that the Son does likewise, we're one. We're tied together. So here's the argument of Jesus. I'm healing on the Sabbath because God works on the Sabbath. And as God works on the Sabbath, I and the Father are one. I'm going to work on the Sabbath. Deal with it. I mean, that's ultimately what he's telling the Jews here. God works on the Sabbath, therefore I work on the Sabbath. That's it. But the Jews want to kill him for healing a man on the Sabbath. The reason the Jews want to kill him is not because he healed the lame man. And that's why I don't think the lame man's the focus of this story. The Jews are the focus of this story. Jesus here is really trying to give belief and trying to give faith to the Jews in this story. The reason the Jews want to kill him is because they understand Jesus is claiming that, yes, I and the Father are equal. I and the Father are one. Because the Father works on the Sabbath, I work on the Sabbath. The Father gives me the ability to heal on the Sabbath, I'm going to heal on the Sabbath. I and the Father are one. So while the lame man may have left believing that Jesus was the Christ, the Jews want to kill him. And ultimately, why? Because the Jews refused to believe that Jesus was God. And this, I think, for us, has to be the foundation of our faith. How do we view Jesus? How do we view him? As you think back to John 2, Mary knew that she had given birth to the Son of God. And she had faith this was the Son of God. And after then he does the sign, the disciples then believe. They believe in his glory. But they don't yet fully believe. It's not going to be till after the death of Jesus that they are going to fully believe. John 4 with the nobleman. The nobleman, he believed beforehand. But after seeing the sign, he fully believed that Jesus was the Christ. Then, whenever Jesus heals the lame man goes away believing, but the Jews refuse to believe that Jesus was the Christ. And what I think this allows us to see, and to answer this question, will we accept Jesus as the Christ? Do I believe that Jesus Christ of Nazareth, born the son of a virgin, is the Christ, the Son of God? Or do I refuse to accept that this man could be truly equal to God? Because the Jews didn't fully understand yet what it meant for Jesus to be God. They kind of understood that this meant that he was equal to God, but they didn't know yet that this meant he had to die and be resurrected. They didn't know the nature of his gospel. They didn't know the nature of his teaching. Belief takes time. There is a preacher who pointed this out back in the 40s, and I would like to expound upon it just a little bit. As you look upon the miracles and the signs in the book of John, they form what I think is an outline for what our life as Christians is based on faith. So first of all, as you go through John 1 through 4, the miracles that you have there are all about consideration. It's all about considering Jesus as Christ. I mean, here's a man who turns water to wine. It gives us a chance to consider him. Well, in the next few chapters then, it's going to lead to controversy. And so this is what we just saw. It's leading to controversy. While in the early stages, some were considering him, it then led to a state of controversy. As you go throughout the rest of the book then, chapters 7 through 11, we'll touch on chapter 9 next week and chapter 11 in 2 weeks. It's leading to a state of conflict where here some accepted, some rejected. Oh no, it's going to be all out warfare in some cases. And then you get to a state of crisis, but then ultimately this crisis is going to lead to confidence, which is then going to be consummated. The signs of Jesus follow this pattern, and I want to make a spiritual application here. Jesus gave signs, first of all, so that he may be considered as Christ. He gave the water to wine. He heals the nobleman's son. He does all this so that he may be considered, so that some may consider him as Christ. But then the next few that he does is going to lead to controversy. It's going to lead to a state where some believe, some don't. Then this controversy is going to lead to a state of all-out conflict, where you have some who are completely for Jesus, you have others who are against him. And we're going to see this next week in chapter 9 to see how conflictual it gets in these chapters. And then in the midst of this conflict, it's going to lead up to a crisis, where the disciples are going to have to ask themselves the question, who are we going to follow? Are we going to follow man or are we going to follow Jesus? And then what they do, as they answer this question, it then leads to a state of confidence where Jesus gives them assurance and hope in John 13 through 17. And finally, all of this is consummated in the resurrection in John 18 through 20. And as I saw this, I began to realize how well this forms a foundation for the story of our faith. Because for each and every one of us, isn't the story of John the story of our individual belief in Jesus? Isn't the nature of the patterns of the signs of Jesus a pattern for our belief that Jesus is Christ? Isn't the pattern of the signs and the miracles of Jesus Christ the story of our faith in Jesus? Because we're the same. You know, when we first hear of this man Jesus, you know, we consider him. He did some interesting things. He turned water to wine. He healed people from the dead. He himself was raised from the dead. He was crucified. You know, we hear him and we kind of consider him. But out of that consideration is going to come a conflict. There's going to be a state of conflict where we're going to have to really ask ourselves the question, what are the claims of this man? He's claiming that he's God. He's claiming that he's Messiah. He's claiming that he's the Christ. And then as we go throughout this state of conflict then, we're then going to come to a state of utter crisis, where then in our faith we have to make the decision, how then will I accept Jesus? And in the midst of that crisis, I must make the decision, how will I accept Jesus? As just a man or as the Christ? And then after that crisis, I can find confidence. My faith grows more and more and more and more. And finally, as we die, it will be consummated in the resurrection of the dead, where we see that all that by faith we have believed, we with our own eyes of our new body will then see. And I think the story of John is the story for each and every one of us as Christians. Like the disciples after the water to wine, we kind of believe. You know, we see his glory and we kind of know he does some interesting things. And like the nobleman, he knew this was an interesting man who had made his son well again. But like the Jews, we can often get to a state of crisis. This man claims that I must take up my cross and follow him. This man claims that I must follow his perfect gospel. This man follows, I must live a moral life according to his ways. This man demands that I live in my life, my thoughts, my intentions, and my actions by love and in truth. And these are pretty radical claims. And out of that conflict, I must come to a state of crisis where I'm just no longer kind of considerate, but I must decide. And so, brethren, my question for us this morning is this. Will I believe or will I reject that Jesus is the Christ? Will I accept him as Savior or will I reject him as just a man? What will I do with Jesus? If you will, go and get out your songbooks, please. The story of Jesus is the most foundational story we can tell. And our belief as Christians in him as Christ must be solidified, it must be strong, it must be solid. Because all of his teaching, all of his doctrine, all of his practices, everything that follows must rest on the foundation that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is truly the Christ. He gave signs and wonders so that then those could believe. Now, I want to, for my invitation, think back to John 2, 23 through 25. In John 2, 23 through 25, it says, Jesus knows what's in man. And then, in John 4, he says, I'm going to give you a sign because you need a sign to believe. Jesus Christ knows what each and every one of us need to believe. He knew what the disciples needed, so he gave them a sign. He knew what that nobleman needed, so he healed his son. He knows what the Jews are going to need, so he raises himself from the dead by the working of the Father. Jesus knows what each and every of these people believed and what they needed. And just as Jesus knew what they needed, he knew what each and every one of us needs. And while we are all created in the image of God, I don't think it's a stretch to claim Jesus knows that we don't need to see water turn to wine. Jesus knows that I don't need to see a young boy healed. Jesus knows I don't need to see a lame man healed. Jesus knows I don't need to see those things with my eyes. But he knows by faith each and every one of us need to see the story of his works. Each and every one of us, by faith, need to see these things that he has done. And then we will believe. Jesus knows what we need to believe, and he's given us all the assurance that we can possibly need because he has been raised from the dead. If you want to accept Jesus as Christ, to follow him as Lord, to follow him as Savior, to follow him in his teaching, in his way, come forward while we stand and while we sing.